Thank you, Mark. One of the instructions that God gives to us in the New Testament is that we are to be given to hospitality. The thing about hospitality is, in the New Testament, and even in the Old Testament, is that we live in a pretty different world today than what they did in the days when this was being written, and how they did various things. So today I would like to take some time to go through what was the Eastern or the Oriental concept of hospitality, and how does one carry on God's directions and in God's orders. Because it's our Western world and our Western churches, we tend to assume that we have satisfied that command when we take somebody out to a restaurant, or maybe we have a cup of coffee with somebody, or perhaps even the more adventuresome, they open their home up for an hour Bible study or something like that, and they think that is what God meant by being hospitable. But from an Eastern perspective, hospitality was a Christian, not only a Christian, but a sacred responsibility of performing what God tells us we ought to. Now, it was true back many years ago in the Midwest, or in the early days of the West, that there was a code that's similar to what God said in the book of Leviticus and other places in the Old Testament. I remember reading at various times when it was absolutely a law of the West that you leave and left a cabin. It might have been a line cabin, or it may have been a trader's or a trapper's cabin that was way up in the mountains or something like that. That the law of the West was that you were free to use it if necessary. But when you left, you were to leave it as you found it, and you were to have it prepared for the next person to come. Which meant that you provided wood and all of the materials necessary for a fire, or whatever necessary things that somebody who was caught in a snowstorm or in a different difficult situation, and they came to that cabin, that they were able to have it handy. Give you an example of why it's important. My wife's uncle was a trapper up in Montana way back in the early years. And sometimes when they went out on their trap line up in Montana, it could get down as low as 60 below zero. So Garland was his name at this time, was trapping, and he had gone into an area pretty remote, and it turned really cold and was blizzardy. But he knew there was a cabin down the way that he was hoping he could get through the storm and get through the cold, and he would get to that cabin where he would find wood already, the fire already laid out, and everything was there, the matches and everything else, in order to start this fire, and he could warm up. So after going through all this storm and his fingers getting frostbitten and his toes getting frostbitten, he got to the cabin. But lo and behold, the person who had been there just before him had used up wood, had used up all of the items necessary to make a fire, and there was nothing left for him to be able to do it. So he had to, with frozen fingers and toes, go out and scrape together the best he could, some items to burn, and to try to light a match with frostbitten fingers is not an easy thing to do, right? Well, he wound up losing, a few of his fingers and toes as a result, because somebody had not actually practiced normal hospitality and making sure they did those things that were necessary for the next person who came along. And it was a very difficult situation for him. He never really recovered. With he had arthritis and terrible arthritis, another thing, for the last number of years. That is partly as a result of what had happened. But this Eastern concept of hospitality is based upon a few scriptures back in the book of Leviticus and the Old Testament laws, which applies to us also, and we will be getting to some New Testament examples, and we'll try to understand a little bit of what their attitude toward hospitality really was. But over in the book of Leviticus chapter 25, coming on down to verse 35, where God says to ancient Israel, and if your brother becomes poor, I mean, hard times may come upon him, and he may lose his job, and he may have all kinds of difficulties, and he becomes a poor individual, and he falls into decay with you, then you shall relieve him. And yes, though he be a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. In other words, take care of his needs, take care of what's responsible for a person coming into your home, that you treat him as, even though he is having hard times, that you take him in and you provide what's necessary for him. Over back a couple, one page into Leviticus chapter 24, he says also in Leviticus 24 and verse 22, and this is what God's law says, that you shall have only one manner of law. There's only one code of God's laws. It applies evenly to all, even to the stranger, to the widows, to the poor, whoever it might be. As for one of your own country, or he says, as well for the stranger, as for one of your own country, for I am the Lord your God. So God's law was, now, I don't want to get into all of the difficulties that we may wind up having in this day and age. I mean, whether we have a fence across the southern border or not. God's system is that those who come into your country as visitors and as strangers need to be cared for and they need to be provided for. Over in the book of Exodus, back a few more pages, in Exodus 22, again, God says in Exodus, the 22nd chapter, and verse 21, it says, thou shalt neither vex a stranger nor oppress him. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And so because you were a stranger in the land of Egypt and you were taken care of down there, you should know how you ought to take care of strangers and or, as he goes on in verse 22, and you shall not afflict any widow nor fatherless child. And if you afflict them in any wise, and they cry out unto me, I will surely hear their cry. God listens to the orphans, to the widows, to those who do not have sometimes the necessities of how to live. Over in Leviticus 19, back where we were in Leviticus 19, and you will find these instructions throughout the books of the Old Testament. But in Leviticus chapter 19, verses 33 and 34, again, we see God's instructions where he says, and if a stranger sojourn with you in your land, you shall not vex him. Now, I'm not exactly sure what that word vex is. I know what it is in English, all right? You don't trouble him. You don't cause him to be uncomfortable. You don't make him feel like he is inferior. You don't make him have to do with less, whatever it might be. But if a stranger or a foreigner sojourning with you in your land, you do not vex him, but the stranger that dwells with you shall be unto you as one born among you. And you shall love him as yourself. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. A little pet rabbit out there. So we read a lot about God's desire that we take care of those who have particular needs and attitudes of maybe have got them into trouble or because they are foreigners or strangers. It's easy for us to think that, well, that applies in the Old Testament, but we don't really need to understand that. But I'd like to just go through, to a large degree, a lot of the material I'm going to be using today comes out of a book called Manners and Customs of Bible Lands by Fred H. White. That's W-I-G-H-T. He has become kind of the authority on the customs in the times of the Old Testament and the biblical times of attitudes toward things and what we ought to do. We do know that God's instructions to us is that we are to be given to hospitality. What did the old people in the Old Testament, what did they consider being hospitable? What are the examples that we find in the Bible of being hospitable? From an Eastern perspective, bottom line was that hospitality meant providing food and lodging for an unspecified length of time to a complete stranger with zero notice. Okay. That your home was always available there for whoever might come and need your facilities. So the purpose of this sermon is just to detail a few of the attitudes that they had toward hospitality and the commitment they had toward it. And the reason that they had that commitment to hospitality was because they considered it both a sacred responsibility and an anticipated duty, which changed the whole mentality about how they did things. You know, Paul tells us in the book of Hebrews, right? Don't neglect to care for the stranger because you might be taking care of angels unaware, right? Well, an interesting concept in the Old Testament was that they considered all people who came as guests into their home, that they were brought there by God. That God brought those people into their home. Therefore, it was their sacred responsibility to take care of who God had brought to them. Now, we don't get that feeling today, do we? You know, that, well, number one, to most people in today's society, God isn't that involved in our lives, number one, right? We don't think about God bringing people, even poor people or needful people, into our lives and into our fulfillment of those requirements. And so that commitment then changes a lot of what has and should be there. Well, I'll just read one other statement. It says, it should be perhaps be noted that while anyone could become a guest, it was expected that having been a guest would render the guest as positively inclined toward the host. That this was a understood thing, that if you had given hospitality, that it was a covenant relationship between the two people. And that basically was what did happen. Some of the best relationships that I have ever had as in the Church of God came about as a result of that kind of hospitality or responsibility being carried out. I remember in Australia when we were down there that the church was fairly new in Australia, and there were people who lived a long ways away from being able to come to the holy days. In fact, one young man that we got very well acquainted with lived all the way up in Cairns in Queensland, which is up the top, you know, the very tip of Queensland, that point of Queensland that goes way up. And he had to come all the way down to Sydney in order to observe the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which was about a 2,500-mile trip. And so some of us who worked in the office in the, at that time provided various home comforts, and we would invite them to come and stay in our house for that week that we kept the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. So this man, Kraft Claus, became one of our best and closest friends because he stayed with us that whole week. And as a stranger, I'd never met him in my life until that time, and we really enjoyed each other's company. At a different year, another woman, Dorothy Perry, came over from Fiji, and she stayed with us during that Feast of Unleavened Bread. And that was interesting because Dorothy Perry had gone through World War II up in Singapore and had been on some of those refugee things and boats that had come over from the Malaysian Peninsula over into Singapore in order to escape the Japanese. And so she had some great stories about the wartime up in Singapore and that area of life. And she became a real close friend also. But the point is that we need to recognize that God expects us to be hospitable. How we practice everything that they did in the Old Testament, I'm not saying we can today. And I'm not here to try to lay down any laws that says when you should pick up a stranger along the roadway and when you shouldn't. I don't know right now, right? I'm not saying that we ought to be stupid, okay? That we ought to be careful about how we deal with strangers, because there are some weird people out there, right? Look what happened in Charleston a couple of weeks ago, right? Some weird people who do some weird things. So we need to be careful, but we need to be careful in two ways. Careful about our own lives and being injured or being hurt, but also careful that we do not become calloused and hardened against taking care of the poor and of the needy and being hospitable because of circumstances that we have today. It's so easy for us to, because we can't really, in our society, do everything that they did in order to have that kind of a bond relationship, for us to be calloused toward other people. And so what I'm saying is, let's be careful that we don't allow circumstances today in our society to dictate our behavior, that we don't allow ourselves to become hardened. These people in the desert, they were, and they had a basic idea or feeling they did not like to eat alone, right? The Bedouins in the Middle East did not enjoy eating their meal by themselves. They wanted to break bread with other people. I think that really is a part of our human qualities, that we do enjoy spending time with other people and using the biblical term breaking bread with other people, that God expects that. Back in the book of Job, for example, when some of these guys were putting Job down as a sinner. And if you read the words of Eliphaz and of Bildad and all the other guys, boy, they were pretty hard on Job, you know, and they kept telling him, "You're a sinner, Job." Whereas God said he was a righteous man. And so they kept trying to make him something he wasn't. But he says in Job 31, regarding this subject, in Job the 31st chapter, the last chapter of Job's personal response at this time. But in Job 31 and verse 16, it said, "If I have withheld the poor from their desire, or have caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel myself alone, and the fatherless has not eaten thereof." You know, I have not done those things. I have extended my hospitality and my riches that God has given to me. I have done my spiritual responsibility in doing what God wants me to do. And so he was defending himself with what he had done. So let's get back to the book of just thinking about hospitality and what some of the requirements are. And I'd mentioned, first of all, that guests are believed to be sent by God. Thus, hospitality became a sacred duty. I don't know whether we can always say that every guest that we might have is sent by God, but I do suggest that maybe God is more involved in our lives and what happens in our lives than what we might think he is, right? And that God can allow individuals or people to come into our lives, and therefore he is the one who brought them about. They considered that heaven had sent the guests to them. Back in the book of Genesis 18, for example, we read in Genesis chapter 18 of Abraham. Now, if Abraham hadn't been a hospitable individual, I don't know what we would be like today. But he said in Genesis chapter 18, beginning in verse 2, and he says, "And he lift up his eye." Well, let's read verse 1. "And so the Lord appeared unto him in the plains of Mamre, and he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day." I'll be mentioning probably a little later, but that was, to a large degree, the tent door was where normally the guest that was going to be in his home in the tent would have been in that first compartment. That was the guest compartment in the tent living situation. And so when Abraham was sitting there in the tent door, it was obviously the door to the tent, but the first place inside the tent was where the guests were supposed to be given. So he lifted up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood by him. And when he saw them, he ran to meet them from the tent door. And he bowed himself toward the ground, and he said, "My Lord, if now I have found favor in your sight, pass not away, I pray you, from your servant." that he recognized that these people were from God, and that God had given him now the responsibility of showing hospitality to them. God brings people sometimes into our lives. We may think, well, it was just accidental that this person showed up and needed something. Who knows but what God maybe had a hand in that, in our lives, in thinking of what he was doing. And so they had this attitude, and Abraham wanted to fulfill that concept in the Middle East of providing for these people. So what kind of people are there? First of all, there are three kinds of guests that the people in the East spent time being hospitable to. First of all, they entertained friends, right? So they had friends who were guests that would come into their home. One interesting thought on this was that there was a tradition in old times, both in the Hebraic as well as even in the Roman New Testament period of time, that when friends came into your home, actually they made a token of hospitality between them as friends. And what they would do in order to show this bond and this relationship is they would take a tile of wood or of stone, and they would divide that tile or stone or masonry tile into two pieces, and they would write on it the names. And each person would write his name on one of the two pieces, and then they would exchange those pieces of tile to show that they had had this relationship with each other. And those things were preserved from one generation down to the next of what they had entertained and done. And so to produce then the counterpart of one of these pieces would guarantee the hospitality of a real friend. It's interesting, if you go back to the book of Revelation chapter 2, it is probably here speaking about this attitude or this particular quality of behavior when it says in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 17, where he says, "And he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him that overcomes will I give to eat of the hidden manna," being hospitable, right? "And I will give him a white stone, and in the stone a new name, written, which no man knows, saving he that receives it." Now, John, in writing to the churches in Revelation, is probably referring back to or thinking about this quality of hospitality, of dividing this tile and writing the name on both, you know, Christ writing his name on the one, and you writing your name, and it was a bond or a covenant between the two in a white stone. That probably is where that originated from. And so you had friends that obviously were responsible for being friends with. But then you would have strangers as guests that, like Abraham, that you would entertain people, or like we read in the book of Leviticus, that you did not despise those who had needs or whatever the situation was. It's interesting, back in the book of Romans chapter 12, where we are told in Romans 12 about this hospitality, in Romans 12 and verse 13, where we are told, "Distributing to the necessity of the saints, given to hospitality." It's interesting that the actual Greek word from the Greek translation actually is philoxenia, which means literally love of strangers or love to strangers. That God wants us, as Paul says, distributing to strangers that come into our lives. But then on the third type of people who might come, and maybe this one's a little more difficult, would be enemies as your guests. And one remarkable feature of Oriental hospitality is that sometimes an enemy is received as a guest as long as he remains in that relationship. He is perfectly safe and is treated as a friend. That he was welcome, if you welcomed somebody into your home, even if he were an enemy, that during that time, he was considered to be the master of your home. That's a Eastern Arabic concept, was that a guest is the master of the home. Now, we may have welcome signs on some of our doors, right? You know, welcome, this is your home, or something like that, you know. But we don't kind of take it so far as to think, well, if you come in my house, this house is yours and you're the boss, right? We don't necessarily want to do that, but that was the Eastern concept, that if a person came into your house as a guest, that guest was the boss of the home for as long as he was there. And what things you did and the things that you accomplished and ate or whatever it might be, to a large degree, was determined by the guest, that who was there. There is a certain Oriental tribe of tent dwellers who have that rule that an enemy who, quote, once dismounted and touched the rope of a single tent, he is safe. All right? In other words, if this enemy comes into my home and he has touched any part of my tent or he has been accepted into my dwelling, then he is safe and will be protected. There are a lot of other scriptures that will become more clear on how they apply when you understand somewhat of the concept of hospitality. For example, remember when the angels came to Sodom and Gomorrah and Lot was there with his two daughters, right? Or his daughters. How many of you have had a hard time recognizing, hey, that seems like that's an awful thing, that he was willing to give his two daughters to these savages? And we don't, partly the problem is because we don't recognize that hospitality was such a serious responsibility. And the safety of your guest was such a serious responsibility that they were first in line, first in order of preferences and priority. Now, I'm not here to suggest that I agree with what he did, but I think when you understand the principles of the Eastern concept of hospitality, that it does make a big difference, doesn't it, in how we view that. Not that Lot wanted to give his daughters to be, you know, defiled by these guys, but his first order of priority was the safety of those guests who were in his house. And sometimes that was at the expense of some of the other members of the family, rightfully or wrongfully. So what then kind of provisions should be made for guests? Well, they were to be given, obviously, a room to stay. If they were tent-dwelling people, as I mentioned a while ago, that they actually stayed in that front compartment of the tent. They did not expect any separate room. They did not expect privacy. They did not expect any of those kind of things, but that they did have a place to stay there in the front part. So the men would eat with their guest and sleep with him. And it was in this guest apartment of his tent where Abraham entertained these angels back in Genesis chapter 18. The men were out there in that guest compartment, right? Guess who was in the family compartment behind it? Sarah. Listening to what was going on in the front part, right? But that was where the guest would stay, in that front compartment. And the man of the house or the host would stay there with him, giving up his nice bed and everything else in order to be with this guest. It shows, again, the hospitality. If it were in the city, in the villages and in the cities, they would provide a community guest room. They would be entertained in one of the houses, and they would have more facilities to be able to entertain and to have people come in. Remember in the New Testament, you read a lot about the upper room in the New Testament. That was the guest room. The upper room in some of the houses at that time. So it was showing the hospitality. Remember when Christ and the disciples came and he told this man to prepare, the people to prepare for the Passover, and he had an upper room, right? That was for entertaining and for hospitality purposes. And he would make sure he did what was necessary. So there was a provision. Sometimes in the more expensive places, they would even have a well-furnished room to provide for guests. Go back to the book of 2 Kings for a minute. You will read in the book of 2 Kings. Remember the story of here in 2 Kings about providing of a room for guests. In 2 Kings chapter 4, a lot of these scriptures become a lot more real when you understand what the concept of hospitality was. But in 2 Kings 4 and verse 10, if I can find it here, where he says, let's back up to verse 8. And it fell on a day that Elisha passed to Shunem, where was a great woman. In other translations, it says she was a very rich woman and a famous woman. And she then constrained him to eat bread. In other words, come in as my guest. Be my guest in my home. And so it was that as often as he passed by, he turned in thither to eat bread. So it became a part of his routine as he passed by this woman, this rich woman's house, that he would turn in and she would provide a meal for her or for him and take care of his needs. Verse 9 says, and she said unto her husband, behold now, I perceive that this is a holy man of God which passes by us continually. So let us make a little chamber, I pray you, on the wall. And let us set for him there a bed, and a table, and a stool, and a candlestick. And it shall be when he comes to us that he shall turn in thither. And it fell on a day that he came thither, and he turned into the chamber and lay there. And he said to Gehazi, and then you can go on down and read the rest of the story, but her desire was to entertain any or be hospitable even in a more elaborate way. Let's build this special room. Let's furnish it for this Elisha that he will have something permanent when he comes by and takes care of what his needs are. Well, many of the more rich people actually provided a special rooms. Now, sometimes we do that today, right? We have what we call the guest room. And some rich people have pretty elaborate guest room. And that's good. So what was the custom then when people did come into your home in the old times? Well, there was special greetings, number one. It talks about bowing to your guests, showing a reverence toward. And again, this goes back to the attitude of these people were sent here by God. Therefore, I am going to revere them and I will bow to them and show my recognition of what God has done. So they would bow. Sometimes it was a complete bow and sometimes it was not. Sometimes they would have a more expressive custom of saluting with the head erect, the body a little inclined forward, and by raising the hand to the heart, mouth, and the forehead, that they would greet their guests. The symbolic meaning of this action is to say something like this: my heart, my voice, my brain, they are all at your service. So they would bow, leaning forward, a lot more than what we have just in a handshake, right? Especially a weak handshake. No. There's a lot more involved in it, that they expressed this feeling that, hey, I am your servant now. You may have come here as a guest to me. Now you are the one that I am serving, and I am bowing to before you and showing my preferences. So upon entering an Arab home or a tent, they would always say, Salam alaikum, which means peace be unto you, right? Remember in the New Testament, what was the term Christ used over and over and over again when after his resurrection and he went and met with his disciples? What was the term he said? Peace be unto you, right? That was the greetings that was customary in the East to request that peace be upon their lives, and that they be a recipient of the blessings of God. And then the guests would respond with the words of Wa alaikum es al salam, which means, and on you peace. No, it's just an exchanging of that kind of relationship and the understanding that we are now entering into a mutual covenant relationship of friendship. That is what's important for us to recognize, is that when two people break bread or they have this relationship with each other, that it's more than just a relationship. It is a kind of a contractual covenant type of relationship that we have with one another. Remember back in Luke chapter 10, you will find examples all the way through the New Testament of things that are built upon this concept of hospitality. But in Luke chapter 10 and verse 5 and 6, where he says, and into whatsoever house you enter, and he's talking about the disciples as he was commissioning them and sending them out in Luke chapter 10. And he says, and to whatsoever house you enter, first say, peace be unto this house. That was based again on the concept of them having shown you hospitality and inviting you to come into their home, that then they were to express their desire that they be blessed as a result of it. Well, I think we're all very familiar with the concept of kissing in the East, right? thing that we need to realize is that custom is is very congruent with our hearty handshake, okay, but much more deep than that. That they expressed that love for each other, that care for each other, and they would kiss each other on the right and on the left cheek. Very customary. We don't do it in this country, do we? Although I see a lot of women sometimes do it, all right? Normally, we don't see men do that, right? No, we're too strong for that. But they would kiss one another and to show their love for each other and their care for other. But we have a handshake. Sometimes a dirty handshake, right? It's funny that, you know, when you have a disease epidemic going around, you know what? The suggestion is you don't shake hands, right? That's the custom is that you, well, I remember in college one time we had some kind of epidemic going on. So you'd see all these students and they would be rubbing elbows with one another or something like that, you know, rather than shaking hands. Because they didn't want it spread around to everybody that you would touch elbows. And that was the way of saying hello. We didn't go so far as to say kiss each other, right? But they had, that was an Eastern custom that they did show that kind. What they did was they would place their right hand on their friend's left shoulder and kiss his right cheek. And then reversing that, they would place their left hand on his right shoulder and kiss his left cheek. And that was a show of affection or of appreciation for who they are. Many, many places in the Bible, I'm not going to any of them, but remember when Esau kissed Jacob, or you remember when Joseph kissed his brothers, or Moses kissed Jethro, or David and Jonathan kissed each other. What's another custom in the Bible lands of hospitality? And that was removing the shoes. Removing of your shoes upon entering a house to be entertained. A guest would remove or take off his boots or his shoes or his slippers before entering a room. When he recognized that most of their eating was on the mats, on the floor, it makes sense that you would take your shoes off before you tromp across all of the eating mats and everything else, right? So they would take their shoes off out at the front entrance at the time, and then they would proceed to go in. But on top of that, it also would have been very uncomfortable in wearing shoes and try to be seated the way they were at the meal with their feet underneath them. You don't want to sit with your shoes on with your feet underneath you, right? So you take the shoes off. And that was a custom that they did. Remember, Moses was told to take his shoes up. Unfortunately, in our Western society, wearing shoes has become such a part of our lives that we are not afraid to trample on anything and everything, right, with our shoes. I remember when our grandkids were growing up out in San Jose that we had a policy in our home that when you come to the house, you take your shoes off before you come into the house, all right? So you would have a whole line of shoes. Well, sure enough, you know how grandkids are. Most of them are very subservient and will do everything because you ask them. But there's always one, right? There's always one who says, I don't need to take my shoes off. Now what do I do with this? So we had one of our granddaughters who was took more after my wife's side. Nah, kidding. But she was stubborn. And she liked to do her own thing. And she didn't want anybody telling her what to do. Any of you have any kids like that? Or grandkids like that? I don't know where she got it. But obviously it wasn't me. No. But she was took after us both, being stubborn. And she just made up her mind at one time when she came, they came to visit us, that she wasn't going to do it. And so she had her dirty old shoes on, and she was going to walk right across the carpets and come on in. And we said, I won't call her by name, but we said, no, you go back and you take your shoes off. Well, that didn't go across too well either. But finally, she did take her shoes off. And she didn't have any problem with being able to go and do the things she wanted, but that was just our policy in our home that we took our shoes off. We didn't wear ours in the house either. We had slippers or sometimes like that, but we would not wear our shoes. You would be amazed at how much better your carpets are after 3 or 4 years if you take your shoes off and not wear them inside the house. So they would greet each other. Then they would wash each other's feet. They would, after bowing and greeting and kissing, then they would wash the feet of the guest as they came in. And the servant then would assist by pouring the water upon the feet from a copper basin and rubbing the feet with his hands and wiping them with a napkin. And then sometimes they would anoint the head with oil as a special symbol of appreciation for what had been done. So what are then some of the things of caring for a guest after this entrance? One thing was that the first thing you did after they came into your home and you washed their feet and they were relaxed was give them a drink of water. That was the first thing you offered, was a drink of water. And to offer then a drink of water was to recognize, as we will find, that this is worthy of a peaceful reception. And to give a drink of water is the simplest way to pledge a friendship with a person. And to give a drink of water was also to say tacitly that you are welcome into my home as a guest. So you remember back in Genesis 24, where Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, went into this land and met these women, these girls who came to the well, and he asked them for a drink of cool water. So in doing that, he was asking them, if they responded by giving him a drink, then it was automatically assumed that he was going to be a guest in their home. And he was invited as a guest in the home. Makes you realize, though, a little more significance in Mark chapter 9 over here, Mark the 9th chapter. Mark chapter 9, where we find Christ's statement in Mark the 9th chapter in verse 41. For whosoever shall give you a cup of water to drink in my name, because you belong to Christ, verily I say unto you, he shall not lose his reward. You see, giving a cup or a glass of cold water has a lot more significance than just, let's say, satisfying a person's thirst. What Christ was saying here, that we are willing then to be a guest or invited a guest, and we are invited in Christ's name into this special relationship. Then we should be served a meal. And served a meal. There's a statement in the Orient that says like this, that bread and salt bread and salt. So there is bread and salt between us is a statement that many times is made in the East, bread and salt. And when those two things are bound together by a solemn covenant, they really are saying, "I foe will not taste the salt of his adversary unless he is ready to be reconciled to him." That salt was a sign of this special hospitable relationship that was there. Remember in Colossians, and I'll wrap this up here, in Colossians where it talks about letting our speech be seasoned with salt? That is a special covenant relationship between the people. And it's something that by our language and by our terminology and by what we do. And the guest then was made the Lord of the house. I've already mentioned all of that, that he is the master of the house during the time of his stay. And he was to protect that guest at all costs. At all costs. And to abuse that covenant of hospitality was considered to be a very heinous sin and a heinous crime. That's why when Judas shared and broke bread with Christ and then turned around and slew him or slayed him and turned his back on him, it was the most heinous of crimes, right? Rejection of a covenant relationship that is there by mutual relationship of sharing with one another. So that's why it is like Justin was saying, that we as church members, we share our lives with one another, that we should have that same bond of a covenant relationship with one another. And we don't break that. We don't allow ourselves to treat that guest with disdain or whatever it might be. So that hospitality. God tells us very clearly in many, many places that we must be hospitable. One sad example of lack of hospitality was that of Esau toward the Israelites, remember? That Esau would not provide them the hospitable care as strangers, and Esau went on then to actually be elated over Israel's demise and their destruction. And because of their lack of hospitableness and their hospitality, back in the book of Obadiah, a whole book about the relationship of Esau and what it's resulted in, but in Obadiah, that's Hosea, Joel, Amos, and then Obadiah, okay? In Obadiah, there's only one chapter, so it's hard to find. But we find here in verse 9 and 10, or verse 10, in Obadiah, verse 9, or verse 10, "For your violence against your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever." That breaking of that covenant relationship and that bond was so heinous that God said that they would be cut off forever. Now Ammon will be restored. Moab will be restored. Edom will never be restored. They are cut off forever. He says in verse 11, "In that day that you stood on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captives in the forces, and foreigners entered into his gates and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even you were as one of them." But you should not have looked on that day of your brother in the day that he became a stranger. And neither should you have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction. And neither should you have spoken proudly in the day of their distress. You should not have entered into the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Yes, you should not have looked upon their affliction in the day of their calamity, nor have laid hands on them or on their substance in the day of their calamity. And neither should you have stood in the crossway to cut off those of his that did escape. And neither should you have delivered up those of his that did remain in the day of distress. But because you did those things, as the book goes on and says, because of that, you will be cut off forever. It shows just how important hospitality is. Just one final verse we find in the book of Matthew chapter 25. And I'm not going to read all of this, but in Matthew 25, what Christ's instructions are to us. So I'm not giving you finite details about how do you practice hospitality today. What I will say is, if you have doubts or questions about it, ask God. All right? Ask God for understanding. How do you practice these things? All I can say is it says in Matthew chapter 25, some pretty important statements here in verse 34. And then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came unto me. And then shall the righteous answer him and saying, Lord, when did we see you a hungry? And when did we feed you or thirsty and gave you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and took you in or naked and clothed you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and came to you? And the king shall answer and say unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren. One of the least of the members, you have done it unto me. We need to be conscious of the need to be practicing generosity, hospitality, and love and care, and to feed those, especially of the household of faith, but contributing to the needs of the saints and to showing true hospitality. So there's a lot in the Eastern concept that we don't know. All I'm saying is, based upon our understanding a little bit more about what God and what people in the old times considered being hospitable, that we ask all of ourselves the question, how hospitable am I? Am I feeding those that God wants me to feed? Am I truly giving water to those that Christ wants me to give water to? Am I a servant? And am I willing to let somebody else become my boss and my head by being a good host and inviting them into our home in a good, hospitable way?